Five, four, three, two, one, go.
It might seem crazy what I'm about to say. Sunshine, she's here, you can take a break. I'm a hot air balloon that could go to space. With the air, like I don't care, baby, by the way.
Into the show. So good day, and greetings to all my beloved family out there in BTR land. Greetings to all of our beloved BTR family, and welcome to another Thankful Thursday edition of Let's Talk with Mr. Talk Eric Jackson. Mr. Talk won't be joining us today, so again, I hope you don't mind me filling in temporarily. This is Cloud Nation broadcasting live and direct. Today's show is entitled The Secret History of Guns. It's part two of Guns and Violence. How do we stop it? This is and has been a pretty hot topic, as I told you guys previously, for a while now. And but before we get into today's topic, we're going to listen to a little music as usual. And then we'll get right into the discussion. Oh, and I have a clip, too. I have a clip regarding a few incidents that occurred dealing with the gun violence in particular. So we're going to get into those recent historical events, short clippings, and after the music. And then we'll get right into the discussion. So right now I'm going to start with playing music, and as I said, a couple clips, then whenever you guys are ready, we can open the mics up. The number is 347-838-8622. That again is 347-838-8622. Press button number one if you want to talk, and just enjoy as we groove a little bit. Got some wonderful music for you guys, so I hope you're ready. I hope you're ready for the music mix of the day. And let's get into it.
1200 block of East Meineke looks unassuming, with no visible activity surrounding it, according to a Milwaukee Journal fentanyl investigation. It was, until recently, a storefront sting operation called Fearless Distributing, a front where ATF agents offered money for guns, even to felons. People who live in this River West neighborhood are upset the government would bring that kind of customer into the area.
Honestly, I'm speechless to even think that people were coming in and out with guns of all sorts.
Arnold Howard lives just down the block from the warehouse.
I would like some notice or something to know that I was going to be safe.
An internet search shows the building has been for sale for quite some time. The owner reportedly leased it to Fearless Distributing, unaware it was a front for federal agents. In September, several guns, including an automatic weapon, were stolen from one agent's SUV. In October, the warehouse was burglarized. Allegations are the feds recently left the operation and left the landlord with damage to the building and unpaid bills. Ron Johnson is calling for an investigation, as is Congressman James Sensenbrenner, among others. Police Chief Ed Flynn says one botched operation should not color the entire agency.
Obviously, there was some supervisory breakdown from that investigation, but I would hasten to add the Milwaukee Police Department had a strong, effective partnership with ATF for years. They have helped us take literally hundreds of firearms off the streets of this city.
And neighbors tell me they hope there will be a community meeting soon to answer some of their questions. The spokesman for ATF did not have a comment on this afternoon.
The funerals this week of the children gunned down at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, still has the nation focused on the tragic consequences of our culture of gun violence. The horrible massacre of 26 and 7-year-old children in a suburban Connecticut school has just started a long overdue debate on gun violence and gun culture in America. President Barack Obama promised quick action.
That's why I've asked the Vice President to lead an effort that includes members of my cabinet and outside organizations to come up with a set of concrete proposals no later than January, proposals that I then intend to push without delay.
Well, the Sandy Hook tragedy obscures a deadly epidemic in the black community has been dealing with for decades. Too many guns, not enough mental health services, and too little power to tackle those problems in a meaningful way. While shocking, the 26 women and children killed in Newtown is less than the 80 African-American boys between the ages of 15 and 19 who were killed per month by gun violence in 2008 and 2009. Again, per month. To be clear, the 20 Sandy Hook children are innocents who didn't deserve to die in a senseless tragedy. But a large number of black homicides aren't gang members or drug dealers, but children who die doing nothing wrong. 182 black children between the ages of 1 and 9 were killed in 2010. That's according to the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control. That's a Newtown-sized tragedy. 20 innocent children killed every 40 days in the black community. President Obama, calling for action, said mental health must be considered along with gun control to help stop mass shootings.
We're going to need to work on making access to mental health care at least as easy as access to a gun. We're going to need to look more closely at a culture that all too often glorifies guns and violence. And any actions we must take must begin inside the home and inside our hearts.
Like other forms of health care, that is harder to come by in America, and especially in the black community. According to the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, African Americans have less access to and availability of mental health services and are less likely to use mental health services. And when they do, they tend to receive lower quality services than whites. Joining us to discuss gun violence and mental health in America, psychologist Dr. Jeff Gardier in New York, and here in Washington, D.C., Dr. Ron Bailey, Chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Meharry Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee, and President of the National Medical Association, and Dr. Chuck Williams, adolescent psychotherapist and a professor at Drexel University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
At these cases, what's interesting is that you don't see African Americans participating in such mass violence. What's the difference there in terms of how African Americans are involved in crimes involving gun violence? Then you have these mass shootings where typically they are white males.
Well, my experience has been that very often with African Americans, the issues are individual. There may be an individual conflict or difficulty between them, I think, or the individuals they're having problems with, and access to weapons of destruction, guns and the like, can be used in those type of settings. Clearly, we speak about mental illness and concerns regarding larger groups, such as what we saw in Connecticut. We do have seen that more regularly, I think, in other settings or in other groups, when the use of those weapons are used across a wider scale. It doesn't necessarily mean that the African Americans don't have the same concerns or thoughts, but we haven't regularly seen them used, I think, in this large-scale type manner.
I think that also a part of it is the issue of the types of violence that we see in our community that the doctor already mentioned. It's usually interpersonal, based upon arguments. You step on my sneaks, you talk to my girl, you disrespect me, and that tends to be one-on-one or a small group. When you have these mass shootings, it's usually a person who's trying to make a statement, you know, mental health issues notwithstanding, they're looking to get a lot of attention, so they go to a place like a movie theater or a school, and they get that attention, which is sort of the downside to discussing this, but we should still talk about it. Jeff?
I would also say that when we're looking at African Americans, we're looking more at the inner cities, more density, and therefore the issues they have, again, as one of the doctors said, it's usually a one-on-one, but they're also coming to the attention of other people, school counselors, neighbors, and so on. In some of those isolated areas that we've seen, the rural areas, a lot of those young people are left to their own devices, perhaps come from a little bit more wealth, are not recognized by the mental health system, and spend an awful lot of time alone giving that independence, and therefore when they do release a lot of that rage because of psychosis or personality disorder, it's on a much larger scale.
It's been very interesting as I listen to people break down these issues over the past week, and you have folks who say, no, the most important issue has to do with gun control, and others say it's mental illness. Then you have folks who begin to say, no, we must take a look at video games. And the argument that I keep making is that in order for us to address this issue, it has to be holistic. You have to factor all those things. Because as Jeff said, Adam Lanza spent a whole lot of time by himself playing video games, surrounded by posters and things along those lines of killing, if you will. And so you can't confront this. As I keep saying, there's a gun violent culture in America.
There are an estimated 270 million guns in the hands of civilians in the United States, making Americans the most heavily armed people in the world per capita. Yemen, a tribal nation with no history of strong central government or the rule of law, comes in a distant second. Most guns are in the hands of careful and law-abiding citizens, but not all. By one estimate, guns shoot more than 100,000 people a year in the U.S. when the number of homicides, suicides, and accidents were all added together. America's collective memory of the Wild West in the 1800s, the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King half a century ago, is punctuated by gun violence. In fact, there were guns in America long before America was even born. Early settlers in several states were required by law to own and maintain weapons as a matter of collective defense. By the time the U.S. was established, its citizens had taken up arms not only against their Native American neighbors, but the army of their own king. The new Constitution reflected that in its Bill of Rights, declaring that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. For more than two centuries, that remained an important but largely overlooked guarantee, subjected to a modest series of controls. But in 2008 and 2010, landmark Supreme Court rulings gave that constitutional right new power, dramatically diminishing government authority to limit gun ownership. As legal reforms helped guns, so did one increasingly powerful lobby. The National Rifle Association, once a relatively modest organization of gun enthusiasts and hunters, has become one of the most powerful political groups in the country. It helps elect candidates to Congress and works to overturn gun control laws in the courts. Norway is still mourning a mass murder that killed 77 people, most of them teens, who that America is by no means unique. But America does seem to be the place the whole world thinks of when apparently ordinary people use guns for gruesome acts of violence. America stands alone in its historic and cultural attachment to guns. America stands armed. Jonathan Mann, CNN, reporting.
Wow. I know that was a lot to digest from the three different interviews and sound bites that we got a chance to listen to. So far we see a pattern of historical evidence of the relationship between guns and in America. So I want to now look at it from a broader perspective and start to identify some of the global components. For example, I know a lot of you guys are aware of, you know, the fact that between 2002 and 2008, Yemen received some $69 million in U.S. military aid, and 496 Yemeni military personnel were trained under the International Military Education and Training Program, IMET. The projected total, which was said by William D. Hartung, the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New York-based New America Foundation, is about $70 million, or roughly the amount provided during the entire administration of former President George W. Bush. The Pentagon secretly shipped tens of thousands of small arms from Bosnia to Iraq from 2004 to 2006 using a web of private companies, at least one of which is noted, arms smuggler blacklisted by Washington and the UN. According to a report by Amnesty International, which investigated the sales, the U.S. government arranged for the delivery of at least 200,000 machine guns, AK-47s to be exact, from Bosnia to Iraq in 2004 to 2005. But through the weaponry was said to be arming the fledgling Iraq military. They said that there is no evidence of the guns reaching their recipient at that time. So NATO and European officials confirmed that there was nothing illegal about the Bosnian government or the Pentagon taking arms to Iraq. They said that the problem is one of transparency in the way the arms deals have been conducted. There are Swiss, U.S., and U.K. companies involved, and the deal was organized through the embassies in Bosnia, and the military attached officers were involved. The idea was to get the weapons out of Bosnia, where they pose a threat, and to Iraq, where they are needed. The NATO official said, which is Mr. Wilkinson, the problem is we haven't seen the end user, a complex web of, and listen to these key words, private firms, arms brokers, and freight firms was behind the transfer of the guns, as well as millions of rounds of ammunition to Iraq at bargain basement prices, according to Hugh Griffin, Amnesty investigator. The Moldovan Air Firm, which is one of the companies, which flew the cargo out of a U.S. air base at Tuzla, northeast Bosnia, was flying without a license. The firm Aerocom, that's another company you need to remember, named in a 2003 UN investigation of the diamonds for guns trade in Liberia, and Sierra Leone, y'all know that's in Africa, is now defunct. But its assets and aircraft are registered with another Moldovan firm, Jetline International. That's another company to remember, Jetline International. Some of the firms used in the Pentagon-sponsored deals were also engaged in illegal arms shipments from Serbia and Bosnia to Liberia and to Saddam Hussein in 2002. The sale, purchase, transportation, and storage of the Bosnian weapon has been handled entirely by a complex network of private arms brokers. There they go again. freight forwarders and air cargo companies operating at times illegally and subject to little or no governmental regulation, says the report. Now, this 120-page amnesty report, it focused on the risk from the privatization of state-sponsored arms sales worldwide. It also said that arms traffickers have adapted swiftly to globalization and that their pros, aided by governments and defense establishments, farming out contracts. Now, the U.S. shipments were made over a year from July 2004 via the American Eagle base at Tuzla. And the Croatian port of Ploce, I might have said that wrong, by the Bosnian border. Now, Aerocom is said to have carried 99 tonnes of Bosnian weaponry, almost entirely AK-47 assault rifles and four flights from the Eagle base in August 2004. Even though under pressure from the EU, the firm had just been stripped of its operating license by the Moldovan government because of safety and security concerns, Amnesty said there was no available record of the guns reaching their destination. Now this is pretty interesting to me, just a little bit that we've come across. Remember, if you guys have some thoughts and some input you want to share, definitely call in. I know I might have hampered a couple of those names, so definitely any of my UK experts, definitely call in 347-838-8622. That again is 347-838-8622, and if you want to talk, just press number one, and we can get you right on in, and you can get into the discussion. I have another little piece of information, because we're just piecing the puzzle together right now. So we're just piecing the puzzle together, and I want to reflect on the bits and pieces of information that we're looking at, you know, because I thought it was interesting personally. So we're going to keep on just breaking down bits and pieces. So I'm going to go right back to one of the sound bites, and then I will present you guys with some more information, and then we can get into this discussion more in depth. So bear with me.
Culture means more than just one issue.
Absolutely, and it's a contract. Remember, the issue of risk management, and risk management basically takes a holistic, multi-tiered perspective. If we're going to commit someone, it's not solely because of any one comment they made. It's because of the comments they made, their past history, what medicines they may or not have been on, and what prior behaviors they actually have been engaged in. This is a risk management issue. We can clearly address mental health concerns, better funding for mental health. They said about loss about $4 billion, as I understand, over the course of the last decade, and that's playing out. And for persons having a harder time receiving care and receiving a longer-term inpatient type care. But equally important is a holistic concern that if you're all going to have difficulty, because we can't manage and prevent concerns around everyone, but you also want to decrease the access to these weapons, these assault weapons, so if you do have an adverse action, it won't affect 20 kids compared to one or a smaller number. Finally, I think you also address concerns regarding education. We live in a culture now where the education is very negative. Whether it's media, whether it's print, whether it's television or radio, whatever, our average kids now can be exposed to 100,000 or more episodes of violence in the course of their lifetime. And although I think that First Amendment allows it to occur, and we can't block it, we can also expect it's not going to have some adverse impact on those particular individuals who are being most psychologically vulnerable based on brain impairment to act out in a negative way.
Yeah, I also agree that we do have to look at those who are much less vulnerable. A lot of kids play violent video games. They don't go out and shoot up a bunch of people. We have to look at those kids who have mental health issues, perhaps where there is some psychosis, again, these personality disorders. We can't keep guns in those particular kinds of homes, for one. And for two, we have to look at the mental health system that is not able to work with young men, especially who are at the advent of mental illness. They don't want to take the medications. So parents have to look within themselves and try to figure out how to get them the best help and certainly how to keep them away from living a life as being gamers, in video games, in being exposed to violence.
Chuck, in this particular case, we saw this young man shoot his mother in the head. She dies. She is buried this week. in a private burial. To the point that Ron made, you know you have a son with mental issues. And one of the ways, according to the reporting, that she sought to bond with him was to go to a gun range.
Right.
Then we find out that prior to this shooting, she leaves the home for a couple of days. So you have a mentally unstable son who spends a lot of time by himself, and now you leave the home, and he's spending 2 or 3 days by himself, and he has ready access to those weapons. To me, that's a perfect storm for exactly what took place.
I agree with you, Roland. You talked about using a holistic approach, and I think the president gets that, and I think that he's going to be attempting to do that along with other folks like the National Medical Association. I'm a member of the APA. Look, I have a joint faculty appointment in psychology and education. Let me pull it together for you. The reality is a lot of parents don't want to talk about the issues that their kids face. They're in denial. When I did school-based behavioral health for 7 years, it's one of the greatest challenges I faced. I said, you know, this kid got into a fight. He smacked the teacher. He's hitting kids. He's not focusing. He's not sitting still. He's very anxious. Your kid has a problem. Maybe he just needs, you know, a little rest or needs some more time with his father, or I'll take the video games out. I'm saying, no. As my colleagues will attest to, these are serious mental health issues. He needs to be treated. That can include medication as well as what we call the talking cure therapy. But the other issue is this culture, again, that celebrates violence. And we don't want to talk about that, but I got an Xbox. I was playing it the other day, and I got some violent video games. Although I've talked about Quentin Tarantino's movie with the Jamie Foxx, I'll probably see it. So all of these things that we enjoy, the gun enthusiasts, I don't know if you are, you know, there's a consequence that we have to pay for having this proliferation of these assault rifles. I believe everybody has a right to hunt and to own a gun. I believe the Second Amendment is sacrosanct in a lot of ways. However, we don't need people having assault weapons to go hunting. It just doesn't make any sense.
Jeff, I want to come to you on this one because to piggyback on what Chuck just said, and I think this is what is missing in all these shows I've watched this week, all this conversation. I'm hearing all these networks say, we need a conversation, but folks don't want to have that conversation to say, okay, parents, okay, brothers and sisters, okay, aunts and uncles, here's your role. It seems that we're already trying to shift this thing to what kind of bill can be passed in Washington, D.C., how can we stop guns from coming in, when at the heart of it, you as an adult play a role in terms of the gun coming into the home.
Absolutely. So let's humanize this a little bit. Everyone is right on this, that as parents we have to take much more responsibility. This mother who was killed by her son, I don't want to victimize the victim, but certainly a very poor choice in trying to bond with her child with mental health issues with guns. This is where we are in denial as to what is going on with our children. But we also have to look at the reality. Part of that denial is we don't want to think there's anything wrong with our children. It's the hardest thing that we can face as a parent. And then we have to look at the other major issue, and my colleagues can attest to this. When you have an 18, 19, 20-year-old young male who is now starting to develop schizophrenia, he doesn't want to get treatment. He doesn't want to take the medications because of the side effects. And when he becomes uncontrollable to the parents because he's getting older and getting much more rageful and breaking with reality, you try to get him into an emergency room. Unless he is at that time a specific danger to himself or others, he will not be accepted into the hospital. And if he is accepted, he's there for 2 or 3 days because there's not enough bed space. He's released. He starts decompensating again. And the parents are tearing their hair out because they just don't know what to do. That's a major issue we all will have to address as mental health experts and ramp up our game to address that issue.
Final comment, real quick.
Okay, I was going to say, this is about education, too. We don't know how to embrace kids who are different. We treat them as outcasts. They're by themselves. They take up all these violent thoughts, and then we have these massacres. We have to be able to include. Inclusive education is an answer to.
Well, I'll tell you, we will certainly continue the conversation. And, again, I want people to understand, you're right. We're not trying, you know, the mother, she was shot and killed, and she's a victim. But I also say that when people say, well, the person who does it, they're going to find a way to do it anyway. And I'm saying, you probably are right, but don't make it easy. At some point, you can't say, I can't have those weapons in the house if I know I have an unstable child. Ron, Chuck, Jeff, we appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Wow. So that was the final piece of that particular clip. And I wanted to look at some interesting facts behind the secret history of guns. And I thought this was surprising to me. And if you guys have some information you want to share, definitely call in 347-838-8622. That again is 347-838-8622. Call in, press button number one if you want to talk. Oh, so one of the interesting things that came to my attention in particular was that, you know, we know that everyone from the Ku Klux Klan to Ronald Reagan, and for the most of its history, the NRA, all worked to control guns. You know, the founding fathers, as they've been deemed, they required gun ownership and regulated it. And no group, however, has more fiercely advocated the right to bear loaded weapons in public than the Black Panthers, who are the true pioneers of the modern pro-gun movement. Now, I found this interesting because in the battle over gun rights in America, both sides have a distorted history in the law, and there's been no resolution in sight. But, you know, when a few eighth grade students gathered on the west lawns of the state capitol in Sacramento and were planning a lunch with California's new governor at the time, Ronald Reagan, and then the tour to the granite building constructed a century earlier to resemble the nation's capital, the festivities were briefly interrupted by the arrival of three young black men and women, or African American men and women, and with 357 magnums, 12 gauge shotguns, and 45 caliber pistols. The 24 men and six women climbed the Capitol steps, and one man, Bobby Seale in particular, began to read from a prepared statement. The American people in general, and the African people, American people in particular, he announced, must take careful note of the racist California legislature aimed at keeping the African American people disarmed and powerless. People have begged, prayed, petitioned, demonstrated, and everything else to get the racist power structure of America to right the wrongs which have historically been perpetuated against African American people. The time has come for African American people to arm themselves against this terror before it is too late. Seale then turned to the others. All right, brothers, come on. We're going inside. He opened the door, and the radicals walked, as they were called, walked straight into the state's most important government building, loaded guns in hand. No metal detector stood in their way. It was May 2nd, 1967, and the Black Panthers Party invasion of California State House launched the modern gun rights movement. Now, the text of the Second Amendment is pretty much maddeningly ambiguous. It merely says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Yet, to each side in the gun debate, those words are they're absolutely clear. You know, gun rights supporters typically believe the amendment guarantees an individual the right to bear arms and outlaws most gun control. Now, hardline gun rights advocates portray even modest gun laws as infringements on the right and oppose widely popular proposals such as background checks for all gun purchasers on the ground that any gun control measure, no matter how seemingly reasonable, puts us on a slippery slope toward total civilian disarmament. So this attitude was displayed on the side of the National Rifle Association former headquarters. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, the first clause of the Second Amendment, the part about a well-regulated militia, was conveniently omitted. To the gun lobby, the Second Amendment is all rights and no regulation. So although decades of electoral defeats have moderated the gun control movement state goals, advocates, they still deny that individual Americans have any constitutional right to own guns. So the Second Amendment, in their view, basically protects only state militias. Too politically weak to force disarmament on the nation, gun control hardliners support any new law that has a chance to be enacted. So now, however, unlikely that law is to reduce gun violence. For them, the Second Amendment is all regulation and no rights. So while the two sides may disagree on the meaning of the Second Amendment, they do share a similar view of the right to bear arms, and both see such a right as fundamentally inconsistent with gun control, and they believe we must choose one or the other. So gun rights and gun control, however, they have lived together since the birth of the country. You know, Americans have always had the right to bear to keep and bear arms as a matter of state constitutional law. You know, today 43 of 50 state constitutions clearly protect an individual's rights to own guns apart from militia service. So, yeah, we've also always had gun control. Now, the founding fathers instituted gun laws so intrusive that, that they were the running for, when they were running for office, the NRA would not endorse them. So while they did not care to completely disarm the citizenry, the founding fathers generation, they denied gun ownership to many people, not only slaves and free blacks, but law-abiding white men and women who refused to swear loyalty to the revolution. So for those men who were allowed to own guns, the founders had their own version of the individual mandate. And that has proved so controversial, and even today, during President Obama's health care reform law, they required the purchase of guns. So a 1792 federal law mandated every eligible man to purchase a military-style gun and ammunition for his service in the citizen militia. Such men had to basically report for frequent musters where their guns would be inspected and, yes, registered on public roads, which is pretty interesting to me. Now, opposition to gun control was what drove the black militia, or you could say African-American militants is what they would consider, to visit California Capitol with loaded weapons in hand. You know, the Black Panther Party had been formed 6 months earlier in Oakland by Huey Newton and Bobby Seale. And like many, of those groups, many in the African-American community at that time, Newton and Seale were frustrated with the failed promise of the Civil Rights Movement. You know, Brown versus Board of Education, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 were legal landmarks. But they had yet to deliver equal opportunity. So in Newton and Seale's view, the only tangible outcome of the Civil Rights Movement had been more violence and oppression, much of it committed by the very entity meant to protect and serve the public, the police. So inspired by the teachings of Malcolm X, Newton and Seale decided to fight back before he was assassinated in 1965. Malcolm X had preached against Martin Luther King Jr.'s brand of nonviolent resistance because the government was either unable or unwilling to protect the lives and property of African Americans, is what Malcolm said. They had to defend themselves by whatever means necessary. I know a lot of you guys remember the Any Means Necessary speech. So Malcolm X illustrated the idea for what, you know, Ebony magazine by posting for photographs in suit and tie, appearing out a window with the M1 Carmen semi-automatic in hand. So Malcolm X and the Panthers described their right to use guns in self-defense in constitutional terms. Article number 2 of the Constitution Amendments, Malcolm X argued, provides you and me the right to own a rifle or a shotgun. Guns became central to the Panthers' identity as they taught their early recruits that the gun is the only thing that will free us and gain us our liberation, in their words. They bought some of their first guns with earnings from selling copies of Mao Zedong's Little Red Book to students at the University of California at Berkeley. And in time, the Panther arsenal included machine guns, an assortment of rifles, handguns, explosives, and grenade launchers, and boxes of ammunition, recalled Elaine Brown, one of the party's first female members. So in her 1992 memoir, some of the material came from the federal government. So one member claimed he had connections at Camp Pendleton in Southern California who would sell the Panthers anything for the right price. One Panther bragged that if they wanted, they could have they could have bought an M48 tank in and driven it right up the freeway. So along with providing classes for African-American nationalism and socialism, Newton made sure recruits learned how to clean, handle, and shoot guns. Their instructors were sympathetic African-American veterans recently home from Vietnam. So for their what they call righteous revolutionary struggle, the Panthers were trained as well as armed, however, indirectly by the U.S. government. So, you know, civil rights activists, even those committed to nonviolent resistance, had long appreciated the value of guns for self-protection. Martin Luther King Jr. applied for a permit to carry a concealed firearm in 1965, and after his house was bombed. So his application was denied, but from then on, armed supporters guarded his home. Also, one advisor, Glenn Smiley, described the King home as an arsenal. William Worthy, a black African-American reporter who covered the civil rights movement, almost sat on a loaded gun in the living room armchair during a visit to King's personage. So the Panthers, however, they took it, they was considered to an extreme by many. They carried their guns in public. They displayed them for everyone, especially the police, to see. And so Newton had discovered during classes at San Francisco Law School that California law allowed people to carry guns in public so long as they were visible and not pointed at anyone in a threatening way. So in February of 1967, Oakland police officers, Oakland police officers stopped a car carrying Newton, Seal, and several other Panthers with rifles and handguns. And when one officer asked to see one of the guns, Newton refused and said, and I quote, "I don't have to give you anything but my identification, name, and address." He insisted. This, too, he had learned in school. He learned that also in law school. So he continued to say, "Who in the hell do you think you are?" An officer responded, and Newton responded back to him, "Who in the hell do you think you are?" As he told the officer, and that he and his friends had a legal right to have firearms. They went back and forth about this discussion, but ultimately Newton got out of the car, still holding his rifle, and when the stunned police officer asked him, what he was going to do with the gun, Newton asked him the exact same question. What are you going to do with your gun? So, by this time, the scene had pretty much drawn a crowd of onlookers, and the officer told the bystanders to move on. But you know, Newton shouted to them to stay. So, you know, California law, he yelled, gave citizens a right to observe a police officer making an arrest, so long as they didn't interfere. So Newton played it up for the crowd in a loud voice. He basically told the police officers, if you try to shoot me, shoot at me, or if you try to take this gun, I'm going to shoot back at you. Yeah, that's how bold these guys were. So although, you know, normally, you know, African-American male with Newton's attitude would quickly find himself handcuffed in the back of a police car, enough people had gathered on the street to discourage the officers from doing anything rash. So because they hadn't committed any crimes, the Panthers were basically allowed to go on their way. And, you know, the people who'd witnessed the scene, you know, were obviously awestruck by what was happening, and not even Bobby Seale could believe it. So right then, he said he knew that Newton was the baddest, you know, person in the world, is what Bobby Seale called him. And, you know, Newton's message was pretty clear, that the gun is where it's at and about and in his words, not mine. So after the February incident, the Panthers began a regular practice of policing the police. And thanks to an army of new recruits inspired to join up, when they heard about Newton's, you know, his bravado and the groups of armed Panthers, they would drive around following the police cars. And when the police would stop, you know, anyone from the African-American community, what the Panthers would do is stand off to the side and shout out legal advice to those who were pulled over. Dom Morford, a conservative Republican state assemblyman from Alameda County, which includes Oakland, was determined to pretty much end the Panthers police patrols to disarm the Panthers. He proposed a law that would prohibit the carrying of a loaded weapon in any California city. And when Newton found out about this, he told Seale, he told Seale that, you know what we're going to do. We're going to the Capitol. So Seale, you know, was intrigued about this Capitol and a little surprised, you know, asking him, like, you know, the Capitol. And so Newton broke it down. He said, you know, Mulford's there, and they're trying to pass a law against our guns, and we're gonna go to the Capitol State, the steps. So Newton's plan was basically to take a select group of Panthers, loaded down to the grills, to send a message to California lawmakers about the group's opposition to any new gun controls. It's quite interesting. So what we've noticed so far is that the Panthers' methods, it provoked a backlash of sorts, you know, an immediate one at that. You know, the day that their state house protest took place, lawmakers said that the incident would speed enactment of Mulford's gun control proposal. So Mulford himself pledged to make his bill even tougher, and he added a provision barring anyone but law enforcement from bringing a loaded firearm into the state capitol. So this is a little bit of the history that I'm sure many of you guys are aware of, that's behind the history of guns. Now, you know, Republicans in California at that time eagerly supported increased gun control. In fact, Governor Ronald Reagan told reporters that afternoon that he saw no reason why on the street today a citizen should be carrying a loaded weapon. You know, he called guns a ridiculous way to solve problems that have to be solved among people of goodwill. And so in a later press conference, Reagan said he didn't know of any sportsman he leaves, you know, home with a gun to go out to the field to hunt, or for target shooting, who carries that loaded gun. So the Mulford Act, he said, will work no hardship on the honest citizens. So it's interesting just to see, you know, some of the backlash and some of the things that you know, brought up, sparked this idea of you know, gun control. In fact, another interesting thing that happened when we look back on the South, you know, and the gun control measures, you know, and many of the other laws that were used for oppressive purposes, you know, the South had long prohibited, you know, both free and slave African Americans from owning guns. So in the North, however, at the I believe the end of the Civil War, the Union Army allowed soldiers of any color to basically take home their rifles. So even African Americans who hadn't served could buy guns in the North, you know, amid the glut of firearms produced for the war. So President Lincoln had promised a new birth of freedom, is what he called it. But, you know, many African Americans knew that those Southerners at the time were not going to go along easily with such a vision for African Americans having access to guns. So as one freedman in Louisiana recalled it, he said that, I would say to every colored soldier, bring your gun home. So even when we track and go way back to the era of the civil rights, when we look specifically the order in January of 1862 that is called the Constitutional Rights of All Loyal and Well-Disposed Inhabitants to Bear Arms will not be infringed. That's of the comment that was made by General Daniel E. Sickles, the commanding Union officer who enforced Reconstruction in South Carolina. And he ordered it in January 1866. You know, when South Carolinians ignored Sickles' order and others like it, Congress passed the Freedmen's Bureau Act of July 1866, which assured ex-slaves the full and equal benefit of all laws and proceedings concerning personal liberty, including the constitutional right to bear arms. So that same year, Congress passed the nation's first Civil Rights Act, which defined the freedmen as United States citizens and made it a federal offense to deprive them of their rights on the basis of race. So Senator James Nay, a supporter of both laws, told his colleagues that the freedmen now had an equal right to protection and to keep the bare arms for self-defense. So President Andrew Jackson vetoed both laws. Congress overrode the vetoes and eventually made Johnson the first president to be impeached, which that's also, to me, some pretty interesting information. Now, interestingly, also, you know, one of the prosecutors in the impeachment trial, Representative John Bingham of Ohio, thought that the only way to protect the freedmen's rights was to amend the Constitution. In Southern attempts to deny black equal rights, he said, were turning the Constitution, a sublime and beautiful scripture, into a horrid charter of wrong. So in December of 1865, Bingham had proposed what became the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Among its provisions was a guarantee that all citizens could be secure in their fundamental rights. It said that no state shall make or enforce any law which will abridge the privileges of immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. We're opening up all this information. The number, again, to call in is 347-838-8622. Definitely call in, share your thoughts, bring your wisdom, bring your input, and regarding the secret history of guns, because I know there are definitely some people that definitely have more insight and input that it can bring you to the table. But this is interesting information to me, because when we look at, you know, the current state of gun laws and all the different discussions about pro-guns or anti-guns, I find it quite fascinating, you know, that when some of the same laws that were used in the past, I like looking at how it's evolved, pretty much the idea of the guns and the history of guns in the laws pertaining to that framework and the whole total legal landscape, how it's evolved over time regarding guns. As I said, you know, in 1871 is when the National Rifle Association was founded, which was among America's foremost pro-gun control organization to date. It was not until 1977, though, when the NRA was really emerged as it's known today. So after the libertarians who equated owning a gun with the epitome of freedom and fomented a widespread distrust against government, if not armed insurrection, emerged after staging a hostile leadership coup. So in the years since, in the NRA that once encouraged better marksmanship and reasonable gun control laws gave way to an advocacy organization and political force that basically saw more guns as the answer to society's worst violence, whether arming commercial airline pilots after 9/11 or teachers after the Newtown incident, which while opposing, you know, new restrictions on gun usage. So, you know, it's hard to believe that the NRA was committed to gun control laws for most of the 20th century, pretty much helping to write most of the federal laws restricting gun use until the 1980s. So historically, the leadership of the NRA was more open-minded. You know, it was more open-minded historically about gun control than someone familiar with the modern NRA might imagine. You know, particularly if you listen to Adam Winkler, stated that a Second Amendment scholar at UCLA, and he's a law, you know, a scholar at the UCLA Law School, in his 2011 book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, he stated that the Second Amendment was not nearly as central to the NRA's identity for most of the organization's history. So once upon a time, the NRA was founded in 1871 by two considered Yankee Civil War veterans, including an ex-New York Times reporter who basically felt that war dragged on because more urban Northerners could not shoot as well as rural Southerners. So its motto and focus until 1977 was not fighting for constitutional rights to own and use guns, but firearms safety education, marksmanship training, shooting for recreation, which was displayed in its national headquarters. Now the NRA's first president was a Northern Army general by the name of Ambrose Burnside. And he was chosen to reflect, this civilian militia mission, you know, as envisioned in the Second Amendment, which pretty much reads a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, the understanding of the amendment at the time concerned having a prepared citizenry to assist in domestic military matters, such as repelling raids on federal arsenals, like 1786's Shays' rebellion down there in Boston, or the British in the War of 1812. Now, his focus was not asserting individual rights, gun rights as today, but a ready citizenry prepared by targeted shooting. You know, so the NRA accepted I believe it was $25,000 from New York State to buy a firing range for $500,000. Well, that's what it's rated today. So for decades, the U.S. military gave surplus to the NRA and sponsored shooting contests. So in the 1920s and the 1930s, the NRA's leaders basically helped write and lobby for the first federal gun control laws, the very kinds of laws that the modern NRA labels as the height of tyranny. You know, isn't that ironic? So the 18th Amendment outlawing alcohol became law in 1920 and was soon followed by the emergence of, big city gangsters, the mob, who outgunned the police by killing rivals with sawed-off shotguns and machine guns, today called automatic weapons. So in the early 1920s, the National Revolver Association, the NRA's handgun training counterpart, proposed model legislation for states that included requiring a permit to carry a concealed weapon, adding 5 years to a prison sentence a gun was used in a crime, and banning non-citizens from buying a handgun. So they also proposed that gun dealers would turn over sales records to police and created a one-day waiting period between buying a gun and getting it. So two provisions that the NRA opposes today. That's quite ironic again. So nine states adopted these laws: West Virginia, New Jersey, Michigan, Indiana, Oregon, or Oregon, if you like to say it that way, California, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Connecticut, in closing. And so, meanwhile, the American Bar Association had been working to create uniform state laws, which is, I find interesting. And they built upon the proposal, but basically made the waiting period 2 days. 9 more states adopted it: Alabama, Arkansas, Maryland, Montana, Pennsylvania, South Dakota, Virginia, Washington, and Wisconsin. State gun control laws were not controversial. They were the norm in this time. So within a generation of countries founding, many states passed laws banning any citizen from carrying a concealed gun. Now, the cowboy towns that Hollywood, lionized as the Wild West actually required all guns be turned in to sheriffs while people were within local city limits. So in 1911, New York State required handgun owners to get a permit following an attempted assassination on New York City's mayor. Between 1865 and 1901, three presidents had been killed by handguns: Abraham Lincoln, James Garfield, and William McKinley. Now, but these laws were not seen as effective against the Depression's most violent gangsters. So in 1929, Al Capone's St. Valentine's Day Massacre saw men disguised as Chicago police kill seven rivals with machine guns. Bonnie and Clyde's crime and gun spree from 1932 to 34 was a national sensation. John Dillinger robbed 10 banks in 1933 and fired a machine gun as he sped away. A new president in 1933 by the name of Franklin D. Roosevelt made fighting crime and gun control part of his New Deal, as he called it. So the NRA helped him draft the first federal gun controls, 1934's National Firearms Act and 1938's Gun Control Act. So the NRA president at the time, Carl T. Frederick, a 1920 Olympic gold medal winner for marksmanship, who became a lawyer, he praised the new state gun controls in Congress. He said, and I quote, "I have never believed in the general practice of carrying weapons." He also testified before the 1938 law was passed, "I do not believe in the general promiscuous toting of guns. I think it should be sharply restricted and only under licenses. So in 1929, Al Capone St. Valentine's Day Massacre, man, like I said, was very, 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 very influential on this, on everything that took place. However, what I find interesting is that these federal arms laws, they imposed high taxes and registration requirements on certain classes of weapons. Those used in gang violence like machine guns, sawed-off shotguns, and silencers, making it all but impossible for average people to own them. However, gun makers and sellers had to register with the federal government, and certain classes of people, notably convicted felons, were barred from gun ownership. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously upheld these laws in 1939. The legal doctrine of gun rights, balanced by gun controls, held for nearly a half century. However, in November 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald shot and killed President F. Kennedy, allegedly. So with an Italian military surplus rifle that Oswald bought from a mail order ad in the NRA's American Rifleman magazine. In congressional hearings that soon followed, the NRA Executive Vice President Franklin Orth supposed a ban in mail order sales, saying, and I quote, "We do think that any sane American who calls himself an American can object to placing into the bill the instrument which killed the President of the United States." But now, new federal gun control laws came until 1968. No new federal gun control laws came into 1968. So the assassination of civil rights leaders, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Senator Robert F. Kennedy, were the tipping point. And coming after several summers of race-related riots in American cities, you know, the nation's political elite feared that violence was too prevalent, and there were too many people, especially urban African-American nationalists, with access to guns. In May 1967, two dozen Black Panther Party members walked into the California State House carrying rifles to protest a gun bill, prompting then-Governor Ronald Reagan to comment. This is where we get back to that story. So there's, in that moment, he said, "There's no reason why on the street today a citizen should be carrying a load of guns." We talked about this. So the Gun Control Act of 1968 reauthorized and deepen the FDR-era gun control laws. It also added a minimum age for gun buyers. It required guns to have serial numbers, and expand people barred from owning guns from felons to include the mentally ill and drug addicts. Only federal licensed dealers and collectors could ship guns over state lines. People buying certain kinds of bullets had to show ID, but the most, I think, stringent proposal, a national registry of all guns, which some states had in colonial times, and mandatory license for all gun carriers were not in it. The NRA blocked these measures. Orth told American Rifle Magazine that while part of the law appears unduly restrictive, the measure as a whole appears to be one that the spokesman of America can live with. The paranoid libertarian hostile takeover, perhaps the sportsmen of America could abide by the new law. But within the NRA's broad membership were key factions that resented the new federal law. Throughout the 1960s, there were a few articles in American Rifle riflemen, saying the NRA was waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to declare the Second Amendment included the right to own a gun. Joanne Burbick recounts in her 2006 book, The Gun Show Nation, Gun Culture in American Democracy. But in the mid-1960s, the Black Panthers Party were better known than the NRA for expressing that view of the Second Amendment. You know, by 1968, however, Burbick notes that the NRA's magazines, most assertive editorials began saying the problem was fighting crime and not guns, which we hear today. So the 1968 law ordered the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to enforce the new gun laws, you know, the ATF. So in 1971, the ATF raided a lifetime NRA member's house who was suspected of having large illegal arms cache and shot and killed him. That prompted what they called the ardent reactionary William Lee, the editor of the New Hampshire's influential Manchester Union Leader newspaper, to call the federal agents Treasury, Gestapo, Burbeck noted, even though later evidence confirmed the weapons cache. So Loeb and other libertarians, elite libertarians with podiums, started to assert that the Second Amendment protected an individual right to guns, like the Black Panthers. But of course, they were seeking to keep the elite gun owners, the elite community, and particularly trying to keep it out in the hands of African Americans specifically, but anyone outside of the African American community, they wanted to ensure that those owners were fully armed. So a split started to widen inside the NRA. Gun dealers thought, you know, they were being harassed. Rural states felt they were being pretty much unduly punished by what was considered to be urban America's problems. So in 1975, the NRA created a new lobbying arm, the Institute for Legislation Action, under Harlan B. Carter. Now, a tougher-minded former chief of the U.S. Border Patrol is what he was known to be. He shared the libertarian goal of expanding gun owner rights. Burdick writes that by 1976, the political rhetoric had gained momentum, and the bicentennial year brought out a new NRA campaign, in her words, not mine, designed to enroll defenders of the right to keep and bear arms in numbers equal to the ranks of the patriots who fought in the American Revolution. Fascinating information, I know. So Harlan Carter, she wasn't just another, you know, hard-headed Texan, so to speak. You know, when you look back on the seas of hostile internal takeover, we're seemed to be everywhere at that time. And so Harlan Carter wasn't just, you know, she wasn't a hard-headed Texan who grew up in a small, just another, you know, hard-headed Texan who grew up in like a small town or anything like that. That was once from the home to frontiers like Davy Crockett. But Harlan, he was an earlier era's version of George Zimmerman, some would say. The Florida, you know, guy who claimed to, who shot Trayvon Martin in self-defense, who claimed to shoot Trayvon Martin in self-defense in February 2012. You know, even though police records in 911 recordings seemed to show Zimmerman was looking for a fight, so to speak. So according to Carol Vinzant's 2005 book, Lawyers, Guns, and Money, One Man's Battle with the Gun Industry, a 17-year-old Carter found and confronted a Mexican teenager who he believed helped steal his family's car. When the 15-year-old pulled a knife, Carter shot and killed him. His conviction was overturned when an appeals court said the jury should have considered self-defense argument. So in November 1976, the NRA's old guard board of directors fired Carter and 80 other employees associated with a more expensive view of the Second Amendment and view of the Second Amendment and implicit distrusting any government firearm regulation. So for months, the Carter cadre, so to speak, secretly plotted their revenge and hijacked the NRA's annual meeting in Cincinnati in May 1977. So the meeting had been moved from Washington to protest its new gun control law. Winkler writes that Carter's top deputy, Neil Knox, was even more extreme than him, wanting to roll back all existing gun laws, including bans on machine guns and saying the federal government had killed Dr. Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy as part of a plot to advance gun control. This is what he was stating at the time. So using the NRA's parliamentary rules, the rebels interrupted the agenda from the floor and revised how the board of directors was chosen, committed to NRA. They recommitted the NRA to fighting gun control and restored the lobbying ILA. So Harlan Carter became the NRA's new executive director. He canceled a planned move of its national headquarters from Washington to Colorado Springs, and he changed the organization's motto on its D.C. headquarters, selectively editing the Second Amendment to reflect a non-compromising militancy. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall be infringed. So after Carter was reelected to lead the NRA in 1981, the New York Times reported on Carter's teenage vigilante killing and how he changed his name's spelling to hide it. So at first he claimed the shooting was by someone else, and then he recanted but refused to discuss it. So Winkler writes, the hardliners in the NRA loved it. Who better to lead them than a man who really understood the value of a gun for self-protection? So after the coup, the NRA ramped up donations to congressional campaigns, and in 1977 to be exact, new articles on the Second Amendment appeared. In American Rifleman, Burbeck noted that rewriting American history to legitimize the armed citizen, unregulated except by his own ability to buy a gun at whatever price he could afford. So the revisionist perspective was endorsed by a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee chaired by Utah Republican Orrin Hatch in 1982. When staffers wrote a report concluding it had discovered a long-lost proof of an individual's constitutional right to bear arms. So the NRA's fabricated but escalated view of the Second Amendment was ridiculed by former U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Warren Burger. A conservative appointed by President Richard Nixon in a PBS NewsHour interview in 1991, where he called it one of the greatest pieces of fraud. He said, and I quote, "I repeat the word fraud on the American people, public by special interest group that I have ever seen, in my lifetime personally." But Berger would not have imagined that the U.S. Supreme Court in 2008. 13 years after he died, led by libertarian activist Justin Scalia, would enshrine that fraud into the highest echelon of American law. So by decreeing that the Second Amendment included the right to own a gun for self-protection, in one's home, so to speak, that's the thought process. That's what they were stating at the time. So in ending that, I have one more clip that I'm going to go to, but first let me bring in this song temporarily so I can so I can adjust everything. And so give me one moment, and I'm going to put a quick song on, and I'll get the rest of these notes. For some reason, it's not working, so give me one moment. Technical glitch again.
No!
Yeah, I don't know what was happening with my technology, but I'm opening up mics right now. Finally, I can see people's numbers. I don't know how long you guys have been waiting. So I do apologize. Obviously, I've been having some technical difficulties. So if your hand is up, your mic is open right now. So if you press button number one, I'm opening up your mic. You have some things you want to share, please do.
Mr. Beasley, how you doing today?
Pretty good. Except for having technical difficulties. So I don't know how long you guys have been sitting there. But
I was going to call you. Kobe Bryant, pass the ball, Kobe. Pass the ball. You got some help out here. But
I was looking for it.
I was like, pass the ball, Kobe. We over here.
Yeah.
You can't do it all by yourself, but it's good.
Man.
No, you put a lot of information out there. Now, it's funny how the NRA flip-flop. And I remember, well, I don't remember, but I've read all about the Panthers, and you got it pretty good. But I mean, you recited it pretty good. But I think you may have misquoted Bobby Seale. I read his book, and I don't remember him saying that about at least those words exactly that you use about Huey Newton.
Yeah, mine were nicer.
Nicer?
Yeah, in comparison to what I saw.
I know exactly what Bobby Seale said.
Go ahead and share it then.
He said that Huey Newton, and it's important that you use these words, and I'm not going to use the words, okay, but I'm going to give you a better indication of what it was. He said that Huey Newton was the baddest MF ever to walk the planet. You should read Bobby Seale's book if you have an interest and that stuff, because he'll tell you about how they started, and he'll tell you about Huey P. Newton. Huey P. Newton came from a large family. They were from Louisiana, but he was able to debate anybody over at Merritt College, anybody, and tear them to pieces because he would prepare and he would read. But what he also would do, but besides being a scholar like that, just being really bright and sharp and be able to articulate his words, he would go around the roughest areas of Oakland, and he'd find the roughest guy from that neighborhood and beat him to a pulp. I mean, he did that for sport. He also tells a story in his book about Huey Newton, that he went to a party everybody had turned against him, and they wanted to beat him up. He said, okay, well, that's fine. He says, y'all come outside. He said, I'll fight all of you all at once. I'll fight all of you all at one time. There's like 15, 20 dudes. And they thought he was crazy and left him alone. But just wanted to share that. I was like, he didn't quote Bobby Seale, right? He sanitized that. He's giving us He's giving us the PG version. I guess you saw it.
Yeah, I did, right?
Yeah.
No, I gave it the PG version. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, you gave it the G version. Just want to let you know that that some of us are out here paying attention.
Appreciate it. I was struggling, but I opened up everybody's mic.
You gave us the square from Delaware. The square from Delaware version.
You
kiddies from the big city, but I was paying attention. Now that you know.
Oh man, appreciate it.
I'm gonna pass the mic.
You know, I opened up the mic to everybody who raised their hand. So if you press button number one, I just want to remind you guys, your mics are open, so you can finally say, I know you've been on here for a while, but you can finally say something. Oh, man.
I wouldn't polish my guns up while you was talking.
sound like Wyatt Earp or somebody, huh?
But the most grievous attack on the Second Amendment was this latest case in 2008, the District of Columbia versus Heller, where you had former Solicitor General Walter Dellinger. He was trying to persuade the court that the Second Amendment didn't mean what it said. And D.C. has one of the most craziest gun laws. Even if you got a rifle, it requires you to have the damn thing disassembled, if you can imagine doing that. But, you know, Dillinger, he failed in his persuasion. The court upheld the Second Amendment, which was, I think, a real good victory. I can't understand why come. Something must be getting ready to happen. We seeing these latest attacks on the Second Amendment trying to disarm American citizens and so forth. Beasley, what's your take on it?
I have mixed feelings. I mean, gun violence is pretty dramatic, pretty bad. A guy today just in the Houston area went into a house and killed six people, you know, execution style. It's a lot of mentally ill people or people that snap that have guns that do a lot of damage. But I also know that before any governments have toppled and conquered a people, they disarmed them first. I think people should be more concerned. I mean, you hear all this uproar about the Second Amendment and their right to bear arms. But I think people don't seem to be concerned about the Fourth Amendment, which is very important, you know, which is your right to be safe in your home from search and seizure. Also, the First Amendment's under attack. You see unpopular journalists and bloggers being prosecuted. I mean, you have that one of the scandals they don't talk about that was in this administration that doesn't get as much attention. People talk about Benghazi. You know, that was obviously, you know, there was a cover-up and they sold a different story than what probably actually happened. But you don't hear anything about how they were doing. They were tapping the phones of the Associated Press. They were spying and tapping the phones of the Associated Press. I mean, that's egregious.
Yeah.
That's egregious. That's stopping a free press. So there's attacks on the entire Bill of Rights, and I see more people very concerned about having a gun that hopefully they won't ever have a chance to use, because most people that have guns are responsible with them. If not, you would be seeing thousands of killings on a daily basis. But I think that – go ahead.
Well, you know, it's funny how in the beginning those were Republicans that were trying to maintain the rights of freemen to be armed.
Mm-hmm.
It was a case up in Kansas City where a gun advocate for freedom rights, freemen rights to have guns. They was going to ship guns in a crate that was marked Bibles to the freemen up in the Kansas City area. I can't remember the name of that act. But word got out, and the shipment was confiscated, or should I say intercepted, and they didn't receive them. But you'd be surprised of the Republicans that look at what's the guy's name? The guy beat half to death on the Senate floor. What was Sherman?
Yeah, by Charles Sumner.
Yeah.
Of South Carolina, I think. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, you beat him with his cane right there, over to half to death. Beat him down and bad.
And his friend pulled a gun out and held people off.
Gangster style.
Let him be, it said.
Freedmen should have been able to have guns. They were definitely under attack as they traveled and migrated and tried to set up things. I wonder how Black Wall Street in Tulsa would have. They seemed like they must have had everything but an armed militia to protect themselves.
In the Colfax massacre. Black
I've heard about it. I'm not that familiar with it. Tell me about it. It's in Tennessee, right?
No, it was in South Carolina, too, wasn't it?
Okay. I don't know. You know. Tell me.
Bands of white came upon the courthouse, and blacks held them off until the whites came back with a cannon, then they surrendered. There's so much to the history of this country that no one person could keep up with all this stuff, man. Your head would hurt.
A lot of things happened. A lot of things went on. And, of course, you know, our written history. When I hear younger people talk, not that I'm that old, but they speak of things that I witnessed, that I lived through. And sometimes the story that comes out or that gets accepted doesn't really cover a lot of the intricacies and the things that went on. So I know that must have continued with stories and stuff before my time. You know, people talk about how rough black folks had it. You know, and, you know, they speak of 1964 as being, you know, that it changed a lot. And I guess it did change a lot. It made it against federal law, discriminates housing and other important things. But my grandfather, who grew up in New York, told me, he said there was... He said there wasn't segregation in New York, you know. He said you can go to the movie theater uptown in Harlem, and it costs 10 cents, okay? Or I could have went downtown.
If you press my number,
to the room,
your mic is open.
To the fancy movie theater. He said I would have had no problem as a black man, but it would have cost me a quarter. So most of the time when I wanted to go to the movies, I would go to the movies for 10 cents and save myself a trip. But he said there wasn't, at least in New York City. Said he moved around freely and fine. And, you know, he worked in the post office and worked with everybody, you know, Italians, Irish. And, you know, some of them became his friends, his drinking buddies. So,
yeah, look at all the black militias that was formed after the Civil War. That was one of the things that blacks was able to do, bring home their muskets if they, you know, for a small fee. So they was armed.
They knew that they had to be.
Ku Klux Klan didn't like that. That was one of their main reasons for starting, to disarm the former slaves.
You know, the folks know that the oppressors know what they did. And I know that if I've had my foot on somebody's neck for so long and I've abused them, if I take my foot off their neck or if my foot is removed from their neck, you only expect them to have some vengeance in their heart. So that's real.
Wow. Oh, yeah. I just opened up the mic. Somebody else pressed button number one, so I just wanted to let them know your mic is hot.
This is a switch.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah, that's all facts.
Michael Brown.
Yeah, man, I just tuned in, man. What's up with you?
How you doing, Michael Brown?
Hey, what's up, Ted Dudiak? How you doing? Having a nice day, cleaning up the pad today. Nice day in this area here today.
We know where.
Enjoying them, you know, got the music going, cleaning up. Thought I'd tune in to you guys. What y'all talking about?
The secret history of guns.
Oh, the secret history of guns. Is it a secret?
Well,
I mean, I think we know the history of guns. I don't think it's a secret, right?
Well, we called it a secret because for some, it was really based off of an article. So we entitled it. Yeah, we entitled it based off of an article that was written in the Atlantic. The Atlantic newspaper.
You know, a funny thing about the governor of Florida that was sending crates of guns to those black militias up in Kansas City.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yankee, what did you do with all facts? Did you do something to
him? No, I ain't done nothing to anybody.
Not yet.
What do you mean? Y'all can't do shit to me. What the fuck are you talking about? Y'all can't do shit to me. But
not
no,
yet.
But what was Beasley saying? He was looking at the difference of the North. This, look at our history. That's I mean, you can look at the 12 years a slave. People in the North always. Oh, you muted me. Well, people always had voting rights and stuff up in the North. Yeah, yeah. We've always had, you know, some civil rights in the North, but as a country as a whole, as a people, we've been still struggling in the South. And even the people in the North, look at their wages. They were still fighting certain wages and discrimination when they talk about, look at the Memphis when Martin Luther King died. Those men were kind of saying a sign that I'm a man, but they were talking about wages. And people were trying to just, because, listen, on jobs, if you work in the corporate world, they'll tell you don't discuss salaries because people get paid different. Someone right next to you be doing the same task, the same skills, and they may be getting paid different. It's just the way it is. So we always had a fight. You know, I know the North, up in the North, they had more, a little bit of flexibility. Look when the blacks migrated from the South to the North, when they went to Chicago and the early mid-cities. Of course, we had some factory jobs, but there were a lot of jobs that the black people didn't have. And they stacked them up on projects, and somebody, you know, they had to do something with these people. So what we're going to do, stack them up in the projects and make low income. Because, I mean, because we still, it's a competitive society when we talk about jobs and things of that nature, people hooking up family members. So, I mean, the movement about, you know, discrimination and try to get fair treatment in this country, we've been fighting it since, you know. And you know, as a whole, each individual, you can look into your life and try to be ambitious into your country, but people as a whole group, it's been rough, so...
Everybody who pressed button number one, your mic is hot. I just wanted to let you guys know. Someone just called in, too, and your mic is hot.
Yeah. What are you guys talking about that's got all facts all at Twitter?
Say that again.
We were talking about the Black Panther Party guns. The title is The History of Guns. And Akeem, Cloud Nation, really did pretty well. Apparently the board wasn't working because some of us were on cue. At any rate, but he just told us all about the NRA and their history.
I mean, you can be honest.
No, you did fine,
I dropped the ball. I didn't know that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't know that people called in. It was on the screen. It showed just... It was like no one was there. So when I finally refreshed it, because I refreshed it previously, and then it showed somebody called, then it dropped. And then that time when before I refreshed it, it was just blank. It was just my number there, no other callers. So I thought I was just here by myself. So I said, well, I guess I got to keep talking because no one's calling in.
Now you handle it like a real kitty from the big city. You know, we can tell that you're from Chicago and you're not no square from Delaware.
I struggled.
Did good. You did well.
I needed water, and you guys had me over here talking by myself. I blame you guys. It was your fault.
Well, there you go. That's the way it is. That's the way it is.
No, I dropped the ball, though.
Sometimes,
but yeah, everybody's mic is open.
You're not really muting them intentionally. There's some little bug in the system, right?
Yeah, but the mics are open though, so I don't know why anyone.
I think you have somebody muted that may want to talk.
You said I have like everybody who pressed button number one. I see their line is up. So let me see.
No.
But hopefully they're adding value too. That's the key.
Hello.
Oh yeah, that's Maze. Hey, how you doing, Maze?
Okay. Can we finish with the lesson with the people that stuck with the gun?
I'm sorry.
It was very interesting. It was interesting to listen to hear the history of the guns and the people that's fascinated with them and how they came about and why they want certain people not to have them.
Yeah, I thought the information was pretty interesting. So it was a learning moment, at least for me. I know that some people know more about it, because I personally, honestly, I wasn't here, so all I have is the references that I'm able to pull up. But yeah, I was hoping that this would be both a learning moment, a teaching moment, and a learning moment, but more so a learning moment for me. Because I was trying to discover a lot of the history behind the guns, mm-hmm. because, you know, it fell in line with what we've been discussing this week, which is guns and violence and how do we stop it. And so I thought that it would be interesting to look at the history.
Yes, there's a lot of history behind them. And then again, a part of it is good history, because some people use guns to kill so they can eat. Not human beings, they kill things to eat so they can survive. And then you had some people who just wanted to do it to kill people. And I think some of those people are still on this earth today. They want to keep their own, deer hunters use them now, but I don't really hear too much about people using them that much to just go out to feed their families and stuff. Because the risk battle on this in these United States were done in this country, the worst battle that ever was when it came to a gunfight. And that was the North and the South. When they fought each other. And it's fascinating how many people died in one day with that battle. And they're still fighting each other today. So maybe that's what this is leading up to again.
Well, when Brigham, and I don't know if that was the Brigham who founded Brigham the Young University or not, when he introduced or brought about the 14th Amendment, two words that's very powerful. Of course, the 14th Amendment in itself, which Congress felt the need to further protect the freedmen after Judge Taney's decision, is those two words is doggone, I forgot. Immunities and privileges. Privileges and immunities. And those two words help protect the 14th Amendment as it applies to, you know, the infringement of a person's right to the right of a person to bear arms should not be infringed. It's funny how one thing comes about that would impact another. 14th Amendment, with its further protection of the right of people to maintain their personal properties, and it can't be taken away without due process, is another one. It's two amendments in the Constitution that protect people's property and affords them the right of due process. The 14th, and I think the other one may be the 5th. I'm not sure right offhand.
Wow. Caller that just called in, your mic is hot.
Yeah, what's with the calls being?
Okay, Okay. I don't know what happened to the caller, but I know everyone who has the one, you know, press button number one, your mics are hot. They're open. Well, this is like the quietest that we've been in a while.
Because we are having a discussion on the fascination of the worst weapon that's on this earth.
Wow.
Every day.
Wow. I'm amazed because everybody, I have everyone's lines open, and I'm surprised that no one's talking, but it's amazing. But I know we did talk, I know, at the, you know, the couple of days, a couple of the problems that were listed and that have been brought up in the show, you know, when we talked about guns and violence and how do we stop it, some of the problems people brought up were jobs, I heard economics, I heard community dysfunction. Someone said something about the prison system and profit on crime. I even heard things about government-sponsored gun runners, NRA, ALEC, ATF. It's been so. There's been a lot of information out there. Plus, we looked at the global stuff, and I talked about it at the top of the hour when we talked about some of the global companies that are connected and how they use private firms, arms brokers, and freight firms to use this network of private arms dealers. So that was interesting. And companies like Jetline International was mentioned. I think the other one was Aerocom. We talked about just some of the names. We talked about the IMET, the International Military Education and Training Program. So it was some interesting stuff that we talked about so far.
You know, another thing too, Cloud, is that John Bingham, when he authored the 14th Amendment, he recognized that the Bill of Rights cannot be enforced upon the states. It's remarkable the power that the states individually have from time to time. That's why this whole issue about same-sex marriage and the definition of marriage. And
do you realize that I get muted immediately as soon as I talk?
It's probably because of what you just done.
What did you just do?
So come in the middle of me making a sentence.
Oh, you should. Yeah.
Keep talking, Pianchi. We're listening.
And disrupted, prevented you from hearing what I had to say.
Right. That he shouldn't do that. That's not polite.
Yeah. But that's probably why the Supreme Court has taken the position that it has, you know, state by state, as it applies to same-sex marriage, too.
And that's why every state is legalizing marijuana, I guess, by on their own.
You got, you know, that's another point. I forgot to mention that, too.
Wow.
But the state has to have the fit.
Wait, repeat that? Say that one more time?
I said the state has to have the federal government in order to survive, too, because they can't do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
That's not because some of them were so vicious that they had to have somebody to step in and stop them from doing their dirty deeds that they were doing. And that's why they have laws pertaining to different people and different things. And that's why we have the federal government that step in when they're not doing right by law. Is that right, Pianchi?
Well, I'm one person who lobbies against too much federal interference myself. But you're right, they do play a purpose. One thing that the states was going alone, it wouldn't be citizens of those states wouldn't be forced with having to pay off the federal debt.
Mm-hmm.
So
wow.
I guess they have to work within a group together to get what they need done. And when you... Oh, Piyaki. Somebody asked me a question.
I think... What's that?
Black Kansas. They're broke. And they need money. So where are they going to get it from?
Who?
Because they cut too many taxes.
I didn't hear part of that.
As a Kansas, what happened to them? Now who do they need to help them get out of the situation that they're in? Because they didn't
Kansas.
Do it but the right. Yes.
Well, when Kansas could probably borrow money from another state, like Alaska, where Sarah Palin has done a very good job of making sure that the budget is balanced.
Who?
Sarah Palin.
Oh, if you say so.
I wish I would live in Alaska. Every month I would receive a check based
yeah,
on all royalties.
You don't have to live in Alaska to get a royalty check. You just have to have lived there, and you get a royalty check, not even being there.
Oh,
so you don't
okay.
have to live
I didn't
there.
Know that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. If you're there for a certain length of time, yes, you do get a royalty check. What happened to everybody?
They're all muted.
Yeah, that's, I'm muted.
No, they're all muted.
No, they're all
I tell
muted.
You what, the show is quiet when Eric's not around.
You said, no, they're all muted. They're being auto-muted by the system.
Seems like it.
I've been muted four times, and you...
Well, what was... We was having a conversation. So, Drew, what did you have to put, to bring along with the weapons of mass destruction conversation about guns?
Well,
what
I just got
unmuted.
So, are you telling me, moderator, you didn't mute me?
We don't have time.
I just got muted and unmuted in 10 seconds.
Maybe it's your phone. It sounds like he's a major and a minor instead of minor. You know, he's focusing on the minor things. She asked you if you had something to hear, but he talked about the technical difficulties.
Well, you know, funny. Something if I'm muted. Do you understand that?
If you were listening when the show came on.
You're not following. So you're not following. We're getting auto-muted by EPPR.
Well.
So I guess that means he doesn't have anything to input.
Thing. It's a narcissist thing, Akeem. You might not ever understand.
Yeah, I didn't get it. I was trying to get the point, and he was talking about the technical difficulties that we have, and so I said, "Oh well, I guess he didn't want to answer the question."
Maybe the machine, maybe it stopped again.
Maybe it's a timer on it.
Yeah, we. I'm just amazed. Oh yeah, before I forget, because I don't want to forget it. I know Ebony's show is today, so yeah, and it's actually going on right now. It just started, so anybody wants to check out Ebony's show, it's happening as we speak. I think she's talking about something pretty interesting. I think it's practical ways to let go of the past and have the relationship you want. That's the name of the show. So I definitely think that's going to be worth checking out. And I guess since it doesn't sound like we have a lot to say regarding the subject anymore, so I guess it's time to give our final words then. I've gave too many words earlier unintentionally. So
yeah, you were having technical
So I wanted to listen to you. I really did. I couldn't see anyone in the caller's queue, and I was looking for water, and I wanted a water break, and I couldn't do it because I couldn't find anyone to talk. So, and then when I refreshed the screen, all of a sudden I saw several different numbers on the switchboard. So I don't know, maybe I need to do something with my computer and get it in order. But you know, BTR has been having a field day with me this week.
I wonder why.
It's not. I don't think it's happening with any of the other shows too. I don't know why it's happening on yours, but
No, that's actually not true, because I talked to a couple of people, and I know Renee had some issues with hers, and it was a couple of other shows I talked to that were having problems. Even Ron Reck was having some issues yesterday.
Well,
at some point,
Alan Levy, who runs BTR, is gay, so she didn't know that. So he's gonna throw a glitch in her show anyway. I wonder if she knows if she's running a show and spreading her hate message, because it really is a hate message. You know, she's a bigot that hates gay people in a way that's a little bit it's a little bit too much, you know, someone that obsessed with that. At any rate, but I wonder if she knew that Alan Levy was gay, because, I mean, he'll take her money, but he's gonna screw around with their show.
Wow, I didn't know that. I wouldn't have known.
You guys laugh. Look up Alan Levy. He's a well-known
guy. I believe you, because...
Right.
I mean,
look, it's common. There's lots of gay people out there, and, you know, that own businesses
yeah.
do well for themselves.
Right.
And right.
Oprah.
I mean, so I guess it... Well, that's... So they say. But I think Alan's out. I mean, it's not a secret. I guess it's really not that much of a secret. I think Oprah's bisexual. But... That doesn't make a difference to me. I would.
Right.
Would you marry her if she asked to marry you?
No.
Walter? No.
Yeah. Bianca, you wouldn't?
No.
Oh, okay. Well.
Would you, Beasley?
Yeah, probably. And I don't even believe in marriage. Well, maybe I'm going to make a joke with you.
Suppose
maybe she asked to marry you, would you marry her?
Suppose she set you down in front of piles and piles of papers you had to sign.
Oh, what, prenuptial agreements?
All kind of that and all kind of other things. That
oh, non-disclosure things and everything like that. I'd consider it. I mean, we'd have to negotiate. But yeah, you know, it's good to have an open mind. It'd be wonderful business, wonderful love relationship, business opportunity.
Yeah, I don't know what Oprah's stance is. I was making a joke, but we definitely know that Ellen has you know made no secret about it, so we know.
No, I was talking about Alan Levy, the guy that owns BTR, but Ellen DeGeneres, And you know what, Ellen DeGeneres, she looks like a little pixie little boy. She's really funny. She's got a wit. She's funny. She's a wit. I watch her little silly show sometimes, and she just cracks me up. I mean, she does. When I'm like, oh, that was silly. She's funny.
I don't hate gays. I just don't like the things that they get involved in, which is really none of my business until...
Yeah.
They come out in a certain particular way.
Don't you think that woman, that Renee woman, don't you think that her attention about gays and homosexuality is a little bit, is something odd about it?
Who, a host?
Yeah, well, the girl that called, the young woman that calls in. I don't know.
The black woman, Renee?
Yeah. It seems a little bit too
gung-ho. She has a show. When did her show come on? I hear it from time to time.
It's called, I think it comes on Wednesdays, and I forget the other day. It comes on different times through the week. I know Saturdays, and I think it was on yesterday. So it's called Your Mama.
I think it's called
Your Mama's Black.
Or Gay People Suck, literally.
The last show they did was on the most recent one was dealing with the masculinity of males being threatened. You know, from I think it was something I don't remember the exact title, but it had something to do from masculinity from kings to queens or something like that.
Yeah, I remember seeing it. I was on a show yesterday, I got in an argument with some black men. They was talking about they wanted to have their own. They wanted to disassociate themselves with this country, this government, and so on. And they said we need to form our own courts. That way, we don't have to have So I came out and asked him, well, when you find a person guilty, whose prison are you going to put them in? Boy, it got real quiet. Then I asked three of them, four other questions. By that time, man, I was all kind of sons of Cain and this, that, and the other. And I just asked a question. Innocent question at that.
You get muted for asking questions. You're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to question authority or somebody represent somebody else's words. You're not supposed to ask questions with that. You'll get muted.
I asked another guy. He said he was a business person. That he talking about how he tries to be work with black. And he said that if somebody owed him some money, he wouldn't take him to court. And I asked him, I said, well, you know, you constantly talk about how white banks don't want to lend black businesses money, but what black bank would lend you money if you treated your account receivable that way? Got quiet again. Kind of like it's quiet now.
It's like sometimes I wonder when you have people that always thinking something's coming to get them. I wonder if somebody opened the door and told them they had a place that they could go, would they just leave and be happy where they went? Or would they complain when they got there too?
Probably the latter, Maze. Probably complain when they got there too.
They wouldn't be happy when they got there.
You know, I tell you, life is so short, people might as well just enjoy as much as they possibly can.
And live and let live.
Yeah, live and let live.
So that's the way I see it. But some people are always talking about freedom of speech, but they won't let you speak. They got to hang up on you. And then they come up with the most ignorant stuff you ever want to hear in your life because somebody else had a different point of view. But getting back to the gun thing, I'm wondering why they're so fascinated everybody going to learn how to shoot. Oh, did you hear about the man killing all the people, those people in Houston?
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw that. I got a little bit about it.
Say they weren't
Beasley mentioned.
Yeah, Beasley
mentioned.
Yeah, it was the news.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't make a big deal out of it. Because it's not their focus. So I'm like, 9 people died? Okay, out of that 87 a day, 9 died of it. What do you think somebody died in?
Yeah, the Taste of Chicago is actually going on right now in Chicago. It started yesterday, so that...
Isn't it strange? Some days it's strange when they having stuff. It's so peaceful. And then another time, you turn around, everybody's shooting at each other.
Yeah, that comes with summertime. And some places receive it all year because they have a lot of, you know, warm weather. But for other cities, you know, when they warm up, particularly in Chicago, for some reason, people kind of get out of hand when the city warms up for some reason. I don't know what that is, but it seems to be the norm in any city I've gone to. When the summertime hits, if it's a city that, you know, gets cold at some point, the seasons change, they seem to get a little, you know, more, I don't know, and it gets intense during the summer. That's the way I could put it.
Well, that's the culture. That's the culture in that town. I mean, it's a distinct, in that town, and every town has a distinct culture.
Yeah,
you know, we under.
Yeah,
because
I was
culture.
I was watching a documentary about the wonderful whites in West Virginia. You know, this whole little place was scattered out, this one family. And, I mean, they were killing up people and doing everything. And everybody was scared of them. They had been to jail, got out of jail, went to jail. And I'm like, this is kind of odd. But I don't see I don't see it on the news. But it was just something to watch and see how.
When did this happen?
It's a documentary. It's called The Wonderful Whites in West Virginia. You can pull it up and watch it on the internet.
Wonderful Whites of West Virginia?
Mm-hmm. Same thing they do in Chicago. They do it there. And they
well,
like,
yeah.
And they were sitting there getting high, and the grandmother was sitting on the sofa, and it was about six of them. And she's sitting on the sofa, and they was smoking with her sitting there like she was not even in the house, just disrespecting her. Then you had a coke, one that was on coke. Then you had one like this weed. Then you had the uncle. I mean, it wasn't a TV show. This was real. But then I say, they just only focus on the inner city. They don't go out in the rural areas and stuff and see how those people live. Because it's not important.
Well, you're absolutely right. There's some notorious stuff that goes on in rural areas, too.
Mm-hmm. That's why I always say, when you straighten out what's happening with everybody, the whole situation would be straightened out. But if you just focus on the one group, nothing's going to happen. Because they can't see for looking at that one group instead of looking at them all in a whole. The Hispanics got their own little deal, thing that they do too. So do the Asians, Native Americans. All of them got a cut of a little group of people that not represent the whole family. But they just focus on the inner city. But now they won't be focusing on the inner city because they're gentrificating all the inner cities, so
yeah.
They're not there anymore.
That's what I was going to say, that a lot of, you know, many people say that that real estate has a lot to do, particularly in Chicago and Detroit. A lot of people have been talking about the real estate. When you look at where most of the violence has taken place, it's in prime real estate areas, areas where people really, really want that land because, you know, a lot of them have to run out to the suburbs and they're closer to work when they're in the city. Mm-hmm. So you look at a neighborhood like Inglewood in Chicago, for example. It used to be a thriving business epic center back in the day when it wasn't.
Yeah. That's what happened in D.C., happened in Cincinnati. Anytime they want that real prime real estate, that's what you're going to see in here.
Yes.
And once they move them out, it's like, oh, we can walk our dog with them. I'm like, walk your dog.
And they get it for so it's so cheap too. When by the time they do what they do, they can just go and they had a program in Inglewood where they were selling lots here in Chicago for a dollar. You could buy a whole plot of lot, some land for a buck. So
on Martin Luther King, going away from the city on the other side of
in the U.S. right. Wherever Martin Luther King Drive is, they say.
No, I'm talking about there in Chicago, right there on the other side of Grant Park, where they used to have, they took them apartment houses, those apartments, those six-family apartments. You had some 12-family apartments. Those apartments used to rent out for like $75 a month. They took them apartments, man, and turned them into them units and turned them into condos where they would sell them upwards like, what, $200,000?
Yeah, but they don't tear them down. What the problem is, it's with the bricks and the mortar. They'll get the inside out, but leave the outside because you can't build them like they used to. And you'd be surprised. And when you look around, if the pipes are fixed, everything that the people live there couldn't get done, all of a sudden everything's being done right.
Wow. Well, I know it's about that time for me to go. I don't want the show to
shut
everybody down.
My auntie used to stay off of 39th and Prairie, right there at Winter Coast High School.
Yeah, they call it
right.
Thelonious.
And Walter Williams stayed right around the corner across from the Amber Inn, a friend of mine. But I used to run that neighborhood when I was a kid. I used to go to Chicago and visit my aunt during the summertime. I had another aunt stayed in the projects right down the street from White Sox Stadium.
Good old Comiskey Park.
Well, yes. So if you live around or close to a inner city, and if you own some property, don't sell it, keep it. And one day you look up, you still got your property and everything belongs to you. Your pipes will be fixed and everything else that you've been trying to get fixed, and nobody would pay no attention until the new owners move in. I have some friends, they were going to move up, and I looked at on the city planning thing. I called them, I said, don't sell your house, keep your house. And now the property is worth more than they ever thought it would be. They didn't sell it. And they're happy where they are.
Well, Maze, you got all this. You got all that farmland, those 300 acres,
so
3,000 acres.
I ain't saying no 3,000. Get it straight.
Y'all let us come down there and grow some on it.
You're not growing nothing on that because you're not in my family. You won't be touching
we'll
it.
Lease
That's
it.
What.
We'll lease it from you.
They don't need to lease it. They're doing good.
And
it
help pay the taxes.
No, they don't need help paying the taxes either. We just help. We just keep people out of it to make sure nobody else grow nothing and put roads and stuff in between it. And you know the family house is still there too, Pianke.
How old is it?
Well, my grandfather was 92 when he died. And I think he bought it when he was 20.
Got that wooden porch on it?
Yes, it's a wooden house.
Mm.
Too bad.
Yeah, I need to preserve that.
How you know it's not?
I was just suggesting.
Mm-hmm. So,
you have a big old potbelly stove sitting in the middle.
Well, we had one of those, too. A potbelly stove that was done with wood, where you put the wood in it. And you didn't have to
make the hamburger patties, put it on top.
No, we didn't do hamburger patties. She did tea cakes.
Tea cakes?
Yes. Do you know what those are?
Yeah, I know what they are, but you about the only woman probably around for miles that do.
Oh, really? Yeah, I always make some for my friend from Mississippi, and I make them like a flower, and I always give them to him for his birthday.
Mm. Tea cakes are good.
We know you're having a flashback.
I tell you something else was good too was mackerel patties too. What do we call them? I can't.
It was salmon patties, yeah. Not no mackerel patties.
What kind of patties? Salmon patties. Yeah, you're
yes.
Right.
I don't eat those.
Bread them in cornmeal and peach fried pies.
I did.
You still make them, Ace?
Yeah, but I did a peach cobbler. Last week. Remember that gas show you called that I had sent him the German chocolate cake? I ain't never seen him in my life.
Mm.
And I sent him a cake.
Well,
so, but anyway, we gotta go. He got to go over to Ebony's show.
All right. Well, yeah, Ebony, she always yeah. Talking about relationships.
Well, I have a relationship, so I don't have to be over there.
Me neither. I'll talk to y'all later.
Okay.
But you did a good job today.
Oh, man. I appreciate it because I think I dropped the ball, but I appreciate it.
No, you didn't. You did good with what you had. And nobody would never know. And if you didn't tell them, nobody would until you picked up the line. Sometimes things happen because it's meant to be that way. So you have a good day, and I'll talk to you tomorrow if you're on.
Yes, indeed. Will do. And talk to you tomorrow.
Right.
Thanks again.
Later.
Okay. As you guys know, coming to the end of the show, of course, love and hugs to everyone in the chat room on the phone lines. And you subscribers and archivers of the show, those who have been with us today, it's been an incredible journey. Without you guys, none of this would be possible. So remember to come back and tune in tomorrow, same time and same ETR channel. Tomorrow is Freedom Friday, everyone. So, you know, it's going to be a week of review, highlighting and reflecting open forums on this week's series of discussions on guns and violence, the history of guns, you know, how to stop, you know, guns and violence and how to stop it. And that's it, you know. That's it. Show is over. Close the curtains. Exit the building. Another chapter in the book. Until next time, have a joyous and peaceful day to all.